From KCUR News, this is Casey Kearns, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Coming up on today's show, hear about how Kansas City's approach toward combating sexual assault has changed over the decades.
Missouri farmers are trying to protect their agro-tourism businesses. And Kansas City's waiters dish about local restaurants.
I've always believed that in Kansas City, you can have any theatrical career that you want to, in your own mind. And so many do, and so many still do.
Plus, a memorial off of K-7 Highway inspires our latest What Is That?
I think through the years, it's always been a curiosity, and I think probably for a lot of people, it's a curiosity of who was that?
Listen up for Casey Kearns just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Kearns is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
This month, Pally Rillinger retired after 27 years as a social worker and president of the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. MOXA focuses on reducing the harm of sexual assault and abuse through treatment, prevention, and advocacy. The need for this service continues. According to MOXA, 1 in 6 women nationally will be the victim of a completed or attempted rape. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused during childhood. To find out more about how MOXA's work has expanded over the years, Susan caught up with Pally Rillinger.
The first client that I had in Wyandotte County was 14, and she relinquished her baby for adoption. But I learned much later, and she kept popping up in my career in Wyandotte County, and I learned that she had been horrendously sexually abused, and she was considered borderline mentally retarded at that point. That was the term. And when she popped up later, she had been evaluated by a psychiatrist who felt that she was probably of normal intelligence, but that the emotional and physical trauma that she experienced through the sexual abuse caused her to function at the level that she did. I don't know the final story. I just figured out recently that we're 10 years difference in age, and because her life was so hard, I'm not sure she's still alive.
The FBI recently has come up with some new definitions. Can you talk about that and how that may impact or if it does impact?
Absolutely. It is so long overdue. And so at least it's finally happened. There are so many ways to sexually violate another human being. And to have a very narrow definition does not begin to describe the degradation and the emotional harm that can occur through sexual assault. And so that redefinition and broadening of that has been long overdue.
Now, in a nutshell, for those who may not be familiar, what did the broadening actually do?
Well, it included the range of whether that might be sodomy or oral or rape with objects. Mm-hmm. So it really encompasses the range of sexual violation that can occur, and so that our statistics going forward will be much, much more recognized. As we've heard about crime going down, generally the incidence of rape has not, and the whole need for it is very underreported, and we need to learn how to track that.
Looking back through the years, what has changed the most in the handling of sexual assault?
I think the most significant, probably for adolescent and adult general rape, has been DNA. And again, that's decades old in this world, but it wasn't in existence 27 years ago, and it's a major advance sexual assault nurse examiners, those nurses who are specially trained to specifically collect forensic evidence. In the area of child sexual abuse, there are advanced interview techniques. Those are now understood and are utilized. There are agencies in our community, child advocacy centers, that know how to interview children. And we also know how to more effectively utilize play and art therapy and help parents help their children. So there have been lots of advances.
Well, there was a time that women who were raped particularly weren't taken seriously. Do you still hear something like, well, she says she was raped, but she probably did it to herself? Do you still hear that?
Oh, absolutely. Those rape myths are so prolific. Again, this is such a difficult issue. And one thing that I learned many years ago, even before MOXA, was the whole victimology, that for all of us to feel safer, it's much easier for us psychologically to blame the victim. That distances us from that person's experience. We don't have to be so empathetic. They caused it. And that's self-protection. So unfortunately, that will always exist. But we can do whatever we can to minimize that.
Now, I know that you've mentioned that you feel that it's probably not the right thing to vilify offenders, and that there may be some offenders that could benefit from long-term probation instead of, let's say, locking them up. But there's all this research that shows that some sexual offenders can't really be cured even through therapy. So how do you identify those who could benefit from these longer-term probation ideas or restorative justice versus those who really do need to be away from society?
Well, it requires sophisticated testing. One of the things that is being utilized across the board is polygraphy, really questioning people about their sexual history, learning. And of course, yes, people can work the system or know how to deviate from or work against polygraphy. But generally speaking, with most offenders, that's one of the tools.
You're listening to Casey Kearns. Today we're talking with Pally Rillinger, retiring president and CEO of MOXA. Police response to sexual assault, have you seen it improve through the years?
One of the things that has been very helpful has been the formation of sexual assault response teams, which are multidisciplinary teams to address issues of sexual assault. And that has made a real difference. I think MOXA has also, with some additional key federal funds, Violence Against Women Act, the Victims of Crime Act, been able to provide more outreach to police and law enforcement agencies.
Now, of course, it's a fact that sexual assault and abuse affect all communities. But different communities, of course, deal with the issue differently from a cultural or diversity standpoint. How has MOXA through the years addressed this rather challenging issue?
Well, if I can make a plug for the Healthcare Foundation for Greater Kansas City, I think they have assisted us in providing some specialized programs for outreach to underserved communities. We have been able to recruit more Spanish-speaking staff members and volunteers and minority volunteers generally.
I know a lot of the issues about the LGBT community have come to the forefront lately. How do you approach the issues of sexual abuse and assault in that community?
We have always treated individuals from that community. It's interesting, earlier this year, and I'm not sure if it's been tracked or how we ended up, but we had more male rape victims that we saw at hospital emergency rooms than we had in a long time. And I don't know if that rate was continuing or if it was just serendipitous. But one of the things that I am proud of in terms of MOXA is our youth education and our outreach. I mentioned to 30 school districts. One of the things that we do is we talk about respect for others and because we know that sexual harassment very often includes, and at the prime is calling people gay or harassing those who have different sexual orientations, and that's devastating for teens. That's one of the reasons why they've been the instances of suicide is so high.
Now, I understand that one of the trends of concern is the number of youth being used in pornography and how that's become a new area of concern.
Yes, it's always been in existence, but it's greater than it ever has been. And one of the things that we at MOXA have been looking at is treatment methods to help these children heal from that. Because it's one thing if you've been victimized and it's a kind of a set, even in a private setting, but here you are, not only are you a victim of a horrendous crime, but then you're continuing to be re-victimized. Who is viewing this? How do you ever regain your sense of control? And that is an issue that's being addressed at MOXA.
Now, I read, though, that as you did your last newsletter, it kind of brought you to tears. What was welling up there for you?
Well, it's sort of welling up here. Well, it's interesting. My spouse, as I was nearing retirement, he said, well, you know, I think probably you are, while you're very committed to the cause, you're probably more committed to the organization. And then later he said, well, maybe, and this was over a period of a few weeks, he said, maybe you're really more committed to the people. And it really is sort of that triumvirate. It's the mission, the organization, which is needs to be well-tuned in order to be most effective and efficient, and then the people, but it's the people that make it work, and the people are what, obviously, I'm a people person, and the clients, the volunteers, the staff, that's what drives me.
You may have answered the question, but what will you miss most?
Well, it's the people, not the problems.
Well, Pally Rillinger, thank you for being with us on Casey Kearns today.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
That was Pally Rillinger, retired president and CEO of MOXA. Julie Donnellan is the incoming president of MOXA.
Coming up, hear about Kansas City's restaurant scene from the perspective of a waiter.
And in the world of restaurants, sometimes it's best not to know that the rent hasn't been paid in months, or the host is dating one of the waiters, and that's why he keeps getting all of the seatings. And I got him this job here. Sometimes it's best just to shove all your tips in your pocket, not count each one individually.
You're listening to Casey Kearns.
This is Casey Kearns. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
We got a lot of feedback on our story last week about Kansas City jazz venues in the wake of the closing of several local clubs, including Jardine's on the Plaza. We talked to jazz musicians and critics about what it takes to have a successful venue in Kansas City.
That was music critic and blogger Bill Brownlee. In response to the piece, we heard from Robert Kelly Smithy on our Facebook page. Quote, a new club should be downtown at the Power and Light, but who can afford the rent there?
And Cody Jarrett commented on our website, the loss of any jazz club is significant. However, I have to say, I've been to Jardine several times and never had a good experience. People go there to eat and party, not to listen to music. I'll stick to the Blue Room. It remains a mystery to me why that place isn't packed on a regular basis. And don't tell me people are afraid.
We welcome your comments on all our stories. You can add comments directly on our newly designed webpage, that's at kcur.org, or on KCUR's Facebook page, or send us an email at kcurrents@kcur.org.
Kansas City, Kansas City. For many farmers, corn mazes, farm tours, and pick-your-own apple or pumpkin operations can be important sources of income. But agritourism, as it's called, can also create legal headaches. In Missouri, farmers are backing a bill in the state legislature that aims to reduce their liability if someone gets hurt visiting the farm. Jacob Fenston reports from Central Missouri for Harvest Public Media.
That's an amazing sound.
It is. I love that.
Vera Gelder and her emus, tall, strange birds like ostriches.
Sometimes they get to talk into each other, and it's like a tea party out here.
Gelder's showing me around her farm just outside Columbia.
Yeah, don't trip over the cat.
Each summer, thousands of kids descend on this 11-acre patch of land.
They just come out to visit our farm, see our animals, and enjoy the noises that go on here and everything.
Kids learn about agriculture, and Gelder collects $5 a head. This agritourism helps keep the farm afloat. But bringing people onto the property also brings legal concerns. If someone were to get hurt, Gelder could get sued.
People don't always realize that. Animals kick. Animals bite. Bees sting. All of those things. Now, you've come to my farm. Who's responsible for that, me or you?
Tripping on a pumpkin vine if you're out in a pumpkin patch, or if you reach down and lift a heavy pumpkin and you strain your back, there's nothing I can do as a farmer to be able, other than I can put signs up, but sometimes things happen.
Larry Helms is a farmer in Pulaski County. He says 25 to 30% of his income is from things like hay rides and pumpkin patches. He recently testified before a Missouri House committee on a bill that would protect farmers from being sued if someone trips on a pumpkin vine or a gopher hole, any accident resulting from the inherent risk of being on a farm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ruziska presenting...
Representative Don Ruziska introduced the bill. He's a Republican from Lawrence County.
Agriculture and tourism are two largest industries in the state, so anything we can do to help promote those, bring those two together, and, of course, deal with the liability situation.
Sharon Jones with the Missouri Association of Trial Attorneys. Well, our concern is really that someone who is not acting responsibly would be able to have immunity through the way the bill was originally written.
So what would be an example of something where someone is negligent and harms someone in the public?
Well, the one I like to use is if you're doing hay rides and you haven't checked the brakes on your tractor in 10 years, you know, and somebody gets hurt because the brakes go out, well, obviously you haven't been doing what an ordinary careful person would do, and so you should be liable in that circumstance.
Those concerns helped doom the bill the last two sessions. Ruziska introduced it in 2010 and 2011. It passed the House, but failed in the Senate. Some other states already have similar legislation. Kansas law, for example, provides protection as long as farmers register with the state and post warning signs. In Iowa and Nebraska, there's no such law on the books.
We've tried to attempt this for several years, and it seems to keep hitting roadblocks.
Tom Tabor with the Nebraska Department of Economic Development. He says Nebraska legislators have tried and failed to pass agritourism bills. Without this legal protection, he says, insurance costs can put a damper on the industry.
That seems to be a cost that is somewhat prohibitive for them to even sometimes jump into the agritourism or ecotourism business.
Here in Missouri, Representative Ruziska thinks his bill has a better chance of passing this year. He's altered the language to address some of the concerns raised by the Trial Lawyers Association.
So if we can address that issue, make it safer, deal with insurance issues, bring people to the farms, sell more crops, it's, you know, one of those scenarios, win-win for everybody.
As in Kansas, this bill would allow farmers to officially register as agritour operators. The Missouri Ag Department would also promote their businesses. I'm Jacob Fenston for Harvest Public Media.
Ordering a meal at a restaurant can be a very different transaction, depending on whether you're sitting at the table or standing with a notepad. A recent event at the Writer's Place turned the tables on restaurant diners and opened the microphone for waiters around town to tell stories from their perspective. The host and organizer of I'll Be Your Server Tonight was David Hayden.
Two guests were sitting at a table for four one night. Two of the seats were a booth, and two of them were chairs. They both sat on the booth side, and the lady complained that the booth was too soft and asked if we had something with a little bit harder back. I suggested the chair. She said she preferred a booth. We had reached an impasse. I had a guest tell me that charging $7 for a baked potato, vegetable, and salad was an injustice. I dream to live in a world one day where this qualifies as an injustice. The same people who claim that serving is an easy job are the ones that make the statement untrue. The people who understand that it's a hard job are the ones that make it worthwhile. Likewise, the people who demand special treatment rarely deserve it, and the people who deserve it rarely demand it.
Besides being a server for more than 15 years, Hayden is also a writer and maintains a whole network of blogs, including RestaurantLaughs.com and Tips Squared, Tips for Improving Your Tips. We'll be bringing you some of the stories from I'll Be Your Server tonight over the next couple of weeks on Casey Currents. And the first story is from Mark Manning.
I started my career in the restaurant business in 1975. I was 12 years old. My parents were recently divorced. One of the ways I showed my independence from my alcoholic father was to let my hair grow, a big change from the crew cuts I received from his barber. Chances are a restaurant in my hometown, York, Nebraska, is a very successful establishment. There I was, this little prepubescent 12-year-old boy with long, soft, blonde hair. I was at a foretop handing out menus, pouring ice water into the glasses for this middle-aged couple, their daughter and son-in-law. The father slips his hand down below the table and pinches my ass. I pretend not to notice, unsure of what to say or do. "Oh shit, it's a boy," the man says. I pretend not to notice the snickering. I finish pouring water and I exit backstage behind the swinging doors. How embarrassing. The customer is always wrong. And chances are, the R stands for Reitz. The owners, Ray and Shirley Reitz, who took a gamble and a bank loan and turned Shirley's father's bar and grill into one of Nebraska's finest dining experiences. They said, chances are, we'll make it. Chances are, we won't. In restaurants, you get a lot of on-the-job training. A waitress named Maggie Finley trained me. She was the only African-American on staff, or anywhere in my hometown. Maggie was on work release from the Nebraska State Prison for Women. Well, they didn't call it a prison. They called it the Nebraska Center for Women. But it had barbed wire fences, armed guards, locks, and small rooms. And I knew this because my mother worked at the prison, and we spent Thanksgiving and many of our holidays at the prison with the inmates. At Chances Are, Maggie taught me about pouring coffee, setting up bread and butter, cleaning and refilling. I liked Maggie, and I respected her. I learned very quickly. Maggie got the best tips of all the waitresses. I loved watching Maggie walk across the floor, singing and moving to the spinners, games people play on the jukebox. I was only 12. I didn't really know much about going out. A customer once asked me if he could get a cocktail. I said, no, but we do serve drinks. Another time I told a customer that we served fried chicken and that, yes, they could have their choice of white meat or black meat. I learned a lot about restaurants and I grew up fast. And by the time I graduated from high school, I had 7 years restaurant experience, 2 years as a busboy, 2 years as a dishwasher, and 2 more years frying chicken. I graduated from college with a Bachelor of Arts degree in theater and drama. Well, what self-respecting adult child of an alcoholic father wouldn't? I moved all my belongings into my father's basement for storage, and then I asked if I could store myself there too. I spent one final year at Chances Are Restaurant, directing plays for the local community theater in the giant buffet-slash-dance-hall-slash-beer-garden area because the Legion Club kicked them out of their previous space. A year later, I packed my 2 suitcases and I moved to Kansas City to pursue my life and my theatrical career. I spent 3 years going to auditions, being a production assistant, designing props, stage managing, acting in small plays, barely paying my bills, puppeteering, doing singing telegrams, working in box offices, working 2 and 3 jobs at once. I had been doing some catering for my friend Lou Jane Temple, who had designed props for several shows at the Unicorn. That was where the money was. Lou Jane promised me that when her restaurant opened, I would be a waiter there. Several months later, my landlord asked me to leave my house that I'd been renting in Brookside because she was getting a divorce. She gave me the last month's rent free. I found an apartment, and the landlords gave me the first month rent free. I decided to never again work at the Unicorn Theater unless they would pay me at least $1,000 a week. I started at Lou Jane Temple's restaurant, Cafe Lulu. I've always believed that in Kansas City, you can have any theatrical career that you want to, in your own mind. And so many do, and so many still do. But the restaurant world is different. The drama is actual, real, and alive. I just couldn't believe I was making this much money. I had the chance to meet so many people. I had the opportunity to introduce the Blue Lou salad to hundreds of happy customers. The artwork was primary, the music was loud, the menu was unlike anything anyone had ever seen in Kansas City. It was so much fun. It was so much fun that it didn't even bother me when 22 cast members of the Rep's Christmas Carol came in and asked for extra helpings of free bread, asked for 22 separate checks, and then couldn't even leave enough money to cover their collective checks. These were the same people that I had served as a production assistant just 1 year earlier when I prepared them the Cratchit Turkey Bologna or the Fred's special disgustingly annoying holiday punch. And when I had the responsibility of walking that nasty little egomaniacal Tiny Tim to all of his entrances. I would never do such a thing, but a lesbian artist friend of mine once bragged of spitting her saliva into the water glass of then-Vice President George Bush Sr. when he was dining at the Hyatt Regency in the mid-1980s here in Kansas City. Cafe Lulu was my favorite theatrical experience. There was always drama. The show was experimental, the food was incredible, the customers were trendy, upwardly mobile, and out-of-towners. At Cafe Lulu, the menu changed monthly. It was world food. It was all served in the middle of the table. Guests were asked to share the food. The menu was difficult for the steak and potato crowd. We were very different than Applebee's. "All the amateurs go out on Saturday night," Lou Jane Temple once told me, and it was true. Lou Jane had many pearls of wisdom. I thought of her as my art mother. Lou Jane once said, "You can tell a lot about what is happening in the world based on who is doing the dishes in the kitchen." At Cafe Lulu, we had Adolfo. He was a thin, older Cuban man who came to America when Castro released hundreds of prisoners to Florida. Adolfo once chased me around the restaurant with a machete. One time we bailed Adolfo out of jail with the help of a $50 pity tip left from four cocaine-addicted women from Johnson County, who Lou Jane refused service to, took back their $50 bottle of champagne, handed their money over, and kicked them out of the restaurant because they had insulted several members of her staff. Cafe Lulu was unlike any other restaurant in the world. After Adolfo, we got Alfredo. Alfredo was a former Nicaraguan freedom fighter who was trained to fly helicopters for the CIA. But now he was trying to understand the English language, how to run our dishwashing machine, and how to deal with all of the openly gay waiters on staff. Alfredo was hot, but he was also very homophobic. I would just smile and nod. That was my secret. Still is. I would just play the part of the fun-loving, blonde, earnest friend, the 12-year-old busboy from the small town in Nebraska. A customer once asked me, "Why do you smile all the time?" I answered, "Because I'm stupid." It was a joke, but it was also the truth. Ignorance is bliss, and in the world of restaurants, sometimes it's best not to know that the rent hasn't been paid in months, or the host is dating one of the waiters, and that's why he keeps getting all of the seatings.
and I got him this job here. Sometimes it's best just to shove all your tips in your pocket, not count each one individually. Sometimes it's best just to smile and nod. The pace, the timing, the orchestration, the dance, the efficiency, the performance. I have very little patience for the slacker bus person who slowly slinks through my station saying, "You done with that? You done with that? Just leave all those damn plates on the table till everyone is finished. That's the etiquette." Or there was this really aggressive bus person at Cafe Lulu we had named Jamie. She would clomp her big black boots over to the table, slam down the water, and then tell the customer, "You should be splattered for blood with blood for wearing all that fur." I waited on tables at Cafe Lulu Wednesdays through Saturdays. And on Mondays, we produced a show called The Spoken Word, our showcase of original writing, performance, and music. On Sundays, they were spent in the kitchen with Lou Jane and Pat Newman. We would drink coffee, cut up chicken for our soul food Sunday, and share our problems of the week. The three of us, were all having lots of boyfriend problems. We played Rosemary Clooney tapes and cried into the boiling potatoes. Sometimes the bartender from Frickin' Frack would trade us marijuana for fried chicken, and we would retire to the back alley for a break. I worked at Cafe Lulu on the very first day it was opened. It was my birthday. It was a Tuesday. Customers waited for over an hour to get seated, and another hour just to get their food. Instead of complaining, the customers kept ordering round after round of drink for the entire restaurant. It was surreal. The servers and the staff were in the weeds all night. It was like an overgrown prairie. It was a wild Tuesday. We had a hit. I worked at Cafe Lulu on the last day it was open. It was Lou Jane Temple's birthday. It was a Monday. We had a show to do that night, and I was to perform as my alter ego drag character, Marlou Lowe Jones, the illegitimate love child of Lou Jane Temple and David Bowie. We had a live band. Lou Jane was at home, sick, in bed. Tonight would be the last night, and that was it. The work, the experience, the service, food service, customer service, self-service, community service. This is my life. And the customer is always. Thank you.
Mark Manning is a writer, performance artist, and coordinator of the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens. And he also hosts the Wednesday Midday Medley from 10 to 12 a.m. on 90.1 FM KKFI. Manning told his story at I'll Be Your Server Tonight, an event at the Writer's Place hosted by David Hayden.
Major League Soccer has tried new ways in recent years to generate publicity for the Superdraft, when college graduates and others are signed to the league. Earlier this month, the day before the Superdraft took place in Kansas City, MLS prospects mixed it up at a museum. KCUR's Laura Spencer brings us this postcard.
Inside the massive hall at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, limestone walls are covered in tapestries, flanked by tall black marble columns. Museum patrons Nina Canode and Bob Sloan stop to sit on a wooden bench after lunch.
I thought it was a very interesting opportunity.
An unusual combination, the art gallery with the soccer.
That's right, soccer in an art gallery. On the eve of the Major League Soccer Superdraft in Kansas City, a handful of MLS prospects, college players in light blue sports jerseys and black shorts, lace up their cleats and get ready to approach a green field. Well, a 200-square-foot green felt canvas, centered on the floor of the vast hall. Families, museum staffers, and fans wearing sporting KC jerseys start to gather.
So this is really a team effort in trying to bring two worlds together.
Museum director Julian Zugasagoitia grew up in Mexico City. He was educated at the Sorbonne in Paris, and he steps in to MC.
Today you will see that six of the top Major League Soccer prospects who will demonstrate many of their skills in a new skill that is painting.
It's not only members of the art community on hand, but also MLS spokesman Dan Cordemanche, who flew in from New York City to help spark some excitement about the Superdraft picks.
These are some of the top young soccer players in North America. These are guys who, future stars in Major League Soccer, future U.S. national team players. So take a look at them today because they're going to be on the world stage one day. Maybe not for their painting, but for their soccer exploits. And our players today, big hand to Tony Cassio, Nick DeLeon.
All right, let's see something, fellas.
The six soccer players gingerly pass silver soccer balls back and forth, warming up with knee kicks and headers. Aluminum trays filled with brightly colored paints line the canvas field. Three players unlace their shoes and plunge their feet into the wet paint. Tony Cassio stamps his feet in light blue, and Nick DeLeon slides in a darker shade. Chandler Hoffman also has some fun spinning on feet dipped in yellow paint.
Now we're getting into the feeling.
All right, ready, cleat?
The next group steps with cleats into the paint as Zugasa Goitia continues his color commentary.
So another kind of quality now with the cleats on, it will give some different marks and different kind of imprints.
Yep. Nice.
And now different colors too.
Oh.
And we almost have an incident, but Casey Townsend survived. No incident here.
According to Zugasa Goitia's analysis, the colors yellow and blue are dominating.
Garza, that seems like salsa, cha-cha-cha.
But then the red card is pulled, although no players are forced to leave the field.
We had our first red card. We have our first red card. That means they came too close to the tapestries.
The final stage of play, they stand near the edge of the canvas and nudge soccer balls, dipped in orange, creating zigzags. Museum director Julian Zugasa Goitia calls it a splash of art, a splash of spontaneity.
I don't know what Jackson Pollock is thinking today.
University of Connecticut midfielder Tony Cassio, with close-cropped dark hair and a wide smile, painted orange stripes on his cheeks. He says he's taken art classes, but this was his first public art performance.
Definitely a unique experience. I had a lot of fun. I was a little nervous at first just with all the people around. I'm not really used to that, but I mean, I guess I got to get used to that now that I'm going to be in the MLS. So.
Tony Cassio was the 14th pick for the Colorado Rapids.
Can we take a picture?
Yeah.
Can you guys stand right there?
University of Maryland forward Casey Townsend mugged for a picture with a few young fans.
I thought it went well. I mean, obviously we've never done anything like that, so it was kind of cool to get out here and experience something you don't do very often.
He also says it was a relief to keep busy before the draft.
A little bit nervous to see where you're going to end up. I mean, it's the start of a whole new life. So there's some nerves there, but I mean, a lot of excitement.
Casey Townsend was selected fifth for Chivas USA. MLS's Dan Cordemanche weighed in on the results.
If they're as creative as they were today on the canvas, if they're that creative on the field in Major League Soccer, then they're going to be a treat for soccer fans, that's for sure.
Museum director Julian Zugasa Goitia says arts and sports can go hand in hand.
What I think we're connecting is to passions, and definitely the arts bring passions into people's lives. Sports, people are very passionate about it. So they're in capturing that passion, I think there's a lot of bridges.
The painting called Creating the Beautiful Game is on permanent display at Live Strong Sporting Park, home of Sporting KC. The 2012 MLS season begins on March 10th. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
After the break, our latest What Is That? Takes us to an unusual monument off of K7 Highway near Olathe. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, the downtown streetcar plan passed another milepost. A police study raised doubts about red light cameras, and an audit rekindled controversy over the Kansas Bioscience Authority. Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Governor Sam Brownback had requested the audit of the agency charged with promoting Kansas bioscience industry, and when results criticized the business practices of the KBA's former president and failed to answer some questions about conflicts of interest, the governor suspended $22 million in funding pending a closer look. Agriculture Secretary Dale Rodman said the KBA board failed to control spending.
They spend nearly 40 cents on every dollar invested in internal expenses. This is an unacceptable performance.
Board Chair Dan Watkins held that the audit shows the agency is properly handling state money.
It's disappointing that there's at least some who are impugning the integrity and ethics of a hard-working, diligent group of people.
Watkins also said the KBA has money in the bank and will continue to invest in promising firms, despite the governor's request that it not do so. A Missouri state representative introduced a bill to do away with the two-year waiting period before the state could intervene in the now unaccredited Kansas City School District. Sponsor Mike Lair of Chillicothe said the district has had enough time.
Well, Kansas City schools have been having problems for a while. And to sit back and wait two more years would, I believe, be unconscionable.
Getting a Kansas City Schools bill passed could be complicated by the demands of some legislators for a single omnibus education bill. Kansas City, Missouri police released preliminary data showing that accidents dramatically increased at some intersections with red light cameras, but they later backpedaled, said their own study was flawed, didn't include data like weather conditions, traffic flow changes, and driver impairment. Still, the matter remains under study by the police board. Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker said she plans to take Catholic Bishop Robert Finn to trial and personally lead the case against him. Her spokesperson, Mike Manser, said the team also will include some other specialists.
One is the trial team leader in sex crimes, and then the head of our major crimes unit.
Finn is charged with failure to report suspected sex offenses by clergy. In December, he got a plea bargain deal that avoided trial on similar charges in Clay County. MoDOT Director Kevin Keith continued promoting making I-70 a toll road between Kansas City and St. Louis. GOP State Senator Mike Kehoe liked the idea.
This is just one option to do that, but it seems like as time goes on, it seems to be the most reasonable option.
MoDOT says the toll option would not require a public vote, but some legislators question how it would get around a prohibition on toll roads in the state constitution. The Kansas City City Council funded an engineering study on streetcars downtown. And Councilman Russ Johnson said that's a bigger deal than it may sound like.
No planning, no preliminary engineering or advanced conceptual engineering has ever been undertaken on transit in modern times. So today we are going further than we've ever gone before.
The city is hoping for a $25 million federal grant for the streetcar system. Wrapping up the week, for the second year in a row, Missouri had the nation's black homicide rate. But some law enforcement officials blame differences in how states report homicides. And the city of Mission asked for a clarification after the Kansas Attorney General opined that its new driveway tax for street maintenance is illegal. This is KCUR.
Pass something that catches your eye when you're walking or driving around? Something that might make you turn your head and wonder,
what the hell is that?
To adapt a phrase from Saturday Night Live, Casey Kearns has been exploring these curiosities in a series we call What Is That? This is one that listener Clifton Benke asked us to find out about, something he sees when he drives down K7 Highway near Olathe. Casey Kearns' Kayla Regan looked into it.
From K7 south, it really doesn't look like much. Just four poles and some kind of stone. But if you take Hedges Avenue, the road that runs next to the exit ramp, you'll come across a parking area. It seems to be designated for the mysterious highway monument. Once you get out of the car, it's easy to see that this stone is actually a gravestone. The poles that surround it are wrought iron and adorned with decorative leaves. To the right of the stone are planted flowers that have died in the winter. The gravestone is about 2 feet tall and shows a hand pointing to the word rest. The stone reads Asa C., son of F.M. and E.F. Smith, born November 15, 1856, died August 30, 1857. That would have made Asa 8 months old when he died.
I think through the years, it's always been a curiosity, and I think probably for a lot of people, it's a curiosity of who was that?
It's Bertha Cameron that shows me the grave. She's one of the founders of the Monticello Historical Society and a lifelong Johnson County resident. The grave is technically located in Lenexa, about halfway between Olathe and the old Monticello area. And from her research, it becomes evident that the story of Asa Smith and his family is very much a story about what was going on in Kansas at that time.
There were people, immigrants, coming from the east, well, from all different directions, really, some of them from the north and some from the south, different directions, to settle this area. As you know from Kansas history, that Kansas Territory was founded in 1854, and that there was this slavery issue.
Cameron's referring to Bloody Kansas, when people from the north and south are rushing here to determine its future as either a free state or a slave state. In 1856, Fountain and Emily Smith, along with their newborn son Asa, moved from Alabama to Johnson County. Even though the Smiths were from the south, Cameron says that doesn't mean they were coming here to push for slavery.
They had southern sympathies, probably. We know that there were others, there were people who came here for that purpose, to make Kansas a slave state, if they came from the south. That doesn't mean they had to. I mean, it doesn't mean that they definitely did, because some of them from the south, you know, didn't care or whatever. They just were looking for the land.
The government previously promised the Johnson County area to the Shawnee tribe. But in 1854, the government decided to let others in to claim the land. Just a few years later, people were rushing here to get a piece of it. Cameron says Johnson County was seen as kind of a paradise, with timber, wild fruits, and prairie hay.
The families of the missionaries had written back home and said that this was a land of milk and honey, that there was everything here that anybody could desire.
Of course, there were a lot of problems most settlers didn't know about. Because there was no way to prove you had claimed land, there was a lot of stealing of deeds and fighting over property. Three people were murdered in 1858. Cameron says this was partly because of the politics of the border war.
And it was also over land claims. They were so eager to get their land and make a claim on it. So there was a lot of lawlessness and a lot of uncertainty at that time period.
Cameron says that although many of the settlers had no idea what they were getting into, Asa's father, Fountain Smith, likely did. Smith bought his first 160 acres of Kansas land from his brother, Asa, for whom he probably named his son. Of course, less than a year after they settled, Asa died. Cameron says there's no way to know how, but it was likely pneumonia or another illness. The Smiths buried their only child on the property, but likely without any frills or excess ceremony.
And I think that they understood that that was a hard life, that it was hard times. And there probably had been deaths similar to that in their family before.
After Asa's death, Fountain and his wife Emily went on to have more children. In 1863, Fountain, the man with Southern sympathies, seemed to have a change of heart. He signed up for the Kansas Militia, which was a Union state by that time.
Right. Isn't that interesting? And that happened so many times. It's just like the men who came to found the town of Monticello. They were all pro-slavery. But then they all ended up in the Union Army as well. I think they could see what was happening eventually.
By 1865, the 160 acres Fountain originally purchased grew to 400. He sold all of it that year and moved to Leavenworth County, leaving behind his son Asa's grave. Fountain spent the rest of his life in Leavenworth County, and Cameron says by most accounts he was pretty successful.
Just to know that he began with 160 acres and ended up in 1865, when it was sold, with 400 acres. So he did pretty good. He did pretty good.
So now, more than 150 years after Asa's death, why do we still care about his grave? Cameron says there are tons of unmarked graves in Johnson County from children who died on the trail west. Why is this one important enough to protect and even restore? It helped that there was a name on the grave, but Cameron says it's also something more than that.
And just think that that was some pioneer, some early settler, and it would be a symbol, maybe, of all of those who came early on.
The gravestone that now sits by the highway isn't the original. It was replaced by Boy Scouts, and a sign next to the grave reads that the site is maintained by Atmos Energy. The four poles around the grave protect it from lawnmowers. So it seems that, for the time being at least, this one child's story is being remembered. For Casey Currents, this is Kayla Regan.
If you have something you've seen around town and you'd like us to find out what it is, just send us an email at kccurrents@kcur.org.
Well, we thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Kayla Regan is our intern. And our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.